welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we're broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And welcome back, because last week we took a week off. There was no new episode of The Sector last Friday, so if you missed it, don't worry, you actually didn't miss anything. I mean, I'm sure they put something on the air, and I'm sure it was very entertaining, but it wasn't The Sector. The Sector is back, however, this week, and we intend to stay back for the foreseeable future. Just if you're wondering, however, about the last episode that we did, episode 8, the Dying with Dignity edition of The Sector, where we interviewed a volunteer from the Dying with Dignity organization. We've been having some technical problems with the website and the podcasting servers, so as I record this, we haven't quite gotten around to uploading it just yet. But have no fear, once we get that uploaded, it will be on our blog, and of course we will be posting it on Twitter and Facebook so that you, our good listeners, can check it out and download it if you missed that episode. And it was a pretty good episode. So, on for today's show, we have lots to talk about. There's been a lot of news, especially in the last week, a lot of important items related to social justice, related to activism, and also, of course, related to civil rights here in Canada and around the world. Unfortunately, a lot of it is bad news, tragically horrible news, and it's no fun to talk about these sort of things, so I'm going to mention some of them and we'll go into a bit of them in a bit more detail, but we may leave it for another episode to really dive into. Later on, we're going to focus on the donor pyramid, and you may ask yourself, well, what is the donor pyramid? And we'll dive into that. It's a bit of an archaic fundraising term, and there actually has been a lot of discussion that maybe this sort of thinking is on its way out. So we'll take a look at that concept and discuss it a bit later on. Of course, we'll also dive into the big question of the week. Now, on last week's show, two of the topics we discussed, net neutrality and the Fair Elections Act. Well, those are in the past right now, but still very much important to the future of democracy here in Canada, as well as the freedom of the internet. So both of those issues, I hope, won't fade away. And I would like to direct you to our website, and so you can learn a bit more about these issues, and again, keep them in your mind, because these are far from over, and we certainly aren't going to take a defeatist mentality when it comes to defending democracy and defending the freedom of the internet. If you want to learn more about these issues, when we have the show notes posted, go to sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, which is our blog, and you'll find all the links to both the podcast, important information that we talk about on the show that might be of interest, as well as more information on our guests and our pitches and the more, you know, charitable aspects that we talk about here on The Sector. Remember, you can also find us on Facebook. We are at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as on Twitter, at Sector Podcast. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ethan Clow. And of course, I'm up there and I tweet all the time. And if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. So lots of ways to get a hold of us, lots of ways to participate in, you know, the big question and our pitches of the week. So I do look forward to your comments, your criticisms, whatever they may be. I look forward to it. Well, as I mentioned, a busy show today. So why don't we take just a quick little break here, remind you of the radio station that you're listening to, and remind you of some of the great content that is available on CITR. We'll be back after the station ideas and show promos.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. Kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR with your host, Ethan Clow. So I mentioned before the break that there was a overwhelming tide of bad news related to social justice and civil liberties around the world. We, of course, know about the kidnapping of the Nigerian girls and the massive diplomatic and international effort that has gone on to raise awareness first and then motivate some action to be done. Of course, there's been almost as much criticism of the campaign to raise awareness as there has been to actually make something happen with regards to the kidnapped girls. Nevertheless, it has raised the question of intervention of social media and the role that social media can play in instigating national change. Obviously, we don't have any answers for this question because this is such a large topic and we need to do more research before we can really nail this down. But it is interesting to see how the response has been ranging from outrage that Twitter has become, well, a forum for social discussion related to something as serious as kidnapping these girls in Africa who are trying to learn, who are educating themselves, who are trying to be empowered. And the way that this has morphed into this sort of discussion of priorities and the hypocritical nature of certain international powers, let's say, using this as a way to perhaps make themselves appear more involved in the world affairs than they really are. A classic example of this, of course, is the discussion related to America in particularly, with the question of, say, drones and the somewhat perhaps cynical, perhaps pessimistic view that if the U.S. really wanted to make a difference in international affairs, maybe they shouldn't, you know, drop bombs on people. Of course, the big question is that not a side discussion, a related topic that needs to be addressed in its own merits? Whereas right now, we're dealing with the question of these kidnapped girls, this terrorist organization that has abducted them, and the international effort to find them, bring them back safely and sound. That's where a lot of the debate is raging. And again, you know, I feel almost silly bringing it up because there's really just nothing that we can add to this conversation at this point other than to hope that things work out fine. Perhaps later on The Sector, we will take a more thorough look at the role of social media and how it affects international diplomatic efforts like this to spread civil liberties and to have an impact on social justice. And of course, speaking of social justice, and again, in unbelievably tragic and very serious news, we've learned of the shooting spree in California near Santa Barbara and the hateful, misogynistic babblings of the perpetrator in this case, his anger and frustration because women didn't want to have sex with him because he felt entitled to sex with women, that if he beckons, they should come, essentially. And of course, the explosive response, this tragedy, this shootings, I mean, eerily reminiscent of the massacre that occurred in Quebec here in Canada. We're left shaking our heads. We're absolutely in a state of shock and just how on earth did this sort of thing happen? And we talked about this on Radio Free Thinker. Me and Don discussed this during the last mass shooting that occurred in America. And again, even that alone, the fact that these things happen so often that we're able to refer to them as the last time a mass shooting occurred when some sociopath was able to obtain weapons, assault rifles and guns of all kinds and went on a killing spree. But on Radio Free Thinker, the last time we discussed this, we looked at some of the different sort of cultural elements that go into sort of American versus Canadian views on weaponry. And it's another world. Growing up here in Canada, growing up in Vancouver, you know, the idea of having a gun was just never something that occurred to me. And I mean, I get that there are certain parts of Canada where you're living out in, you know, the wilderness, essentially. And, you know, a weapon is necessary to, if you're a farmer or if you're just living out in the wilderness and a bear comes along, it makes sense to have a gun, perhaps. But the idea that a young person like this would be able to obtain weaponry, and the fact was pointed out earlier that I was reading, it's not like his state had very crappy gun regulation law. He was in a decent state that had decent gun control laws. Well, decent by American standards, of course. So I really have to wonder, I mean, is the gun culture of America so strong that the danger of these sort of events, the traumatic nature of these sort of events, does not penetrate into the zeitgeist of American consciousness? It seems to always sort of twinge around on the periphery as some kind of scare tactic that conservatives and gun nuts use to motivate people to vote Republican and not Democrat. And not like the Democrats have done much in the first place to limit gun control. I want to air a short little piece here on the show. This is one of the fathers of the victims talking about the situation in America, and very bluntly and with incredible passion. I mean, you can only imagine the pain this person is in. But he talks about the state of affairs in America with guns, with the political motivations behind them. So let's have a listen, and just a bit of a warning. This is pretty emotional, pretty dramatic. So if this sort of thing upsets you, you may want to just turn your radio down for a little bit. And after this, we'll just go to a quick break here on CITR, The Sector. And we'll be back with more after this.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
Talked to me about 45 minutes before he died. What are we talking about? It's just, you know, everybody thinks it won't happen to their family, and then it does. None of us, I don't care who you are immune from this. I don't care where you live. This can happen to you and your family.
He was the most warm, loving, kind-hearted kid you could ask for. I mean, it's just, if you talk to people that knew him, they would tell you, he's the great kid.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
This is Julie Ferris from MOVE. You're listening to UBC Radio CITR FM 101.999.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, with your host, Ethan Clow. We were just discussing the terrible tragedy, the shootings at Santa Barbara, and we played the audio from one of the victims' fathers that is just heartbreaking to listen to, but very powerful stuff. One of the underreported elements about this, at least in mainstream media, has been the sexual violence angle that the killer espoused. There's been a lot of reporting that he was a men's rights activist, that he ascribed to a very antiquated view of female sexuality, and that as a man, he was owed female attention. He was owed attention by women. He was, as a man, entitled to sex and their attention and their autonomy. Now, of course, this is something that I've discussed before on Radio Rethinker and elsewhere, and it's never going to get better until more people start talking about it. I think that the listening audience of The Sector is probably already on board with my personal take on this sort of thing, so I don't expect to change any minds right now. But perhaps, you know, we can make a plea to all those listeners out there to talk about this more. There is a pervasive view in society that a woman can consent to sex by the way she dresses. She can consent to sex by how much alcohol she drinks, how drunk she gets. But of course, none of those things is consent. The only thing that is consent is, well, consent. Yet we have this tendency to view women in a way that implies that their consent to sex is open for interpretation. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. This double standard about how we view a person's autonomy, a person's right to safety, is just shocking in society. No one would suggest that if a man was walking down the street and he was attacked, sexually assaulted, that it came about because of the way he was dressed. It's ludicrous. We don't look at male sexuality that way. So why do we impose this sort of archaic view of female sexuality in the same sense? Now, in response to this debate about misogyny and gendered violence in society, there's been a lot of online discussion in social media since the mainstream media has largely ignored this aspect of society. One of the trending terms on Twitter, Yes, All Women, has been tweeted about and posted about all over, especially in America and the UK, but also in Europe and throughout the Middle East and Canada as well. Now, I mentioned how on The Sector that there's a problem with me talking about this, in one sense, the fact that all of my listeners, all of you guys out there who are listening right now, who are hopefully nodding along and subscribing to the podcast, you all probably agree. And this is one of the problems with the social justice component with any kind of nonprofit or activism mentality, that we often find ourselves preaching to the converted. We're able to share our opinions and give voice to all these really important issues, but the only people who really listen to us are the people who already agree with us. And the problem with that, of course, is that the people who really need to hear this, the people that we actually need to convince, they've already tuned us out. They're not listening anymore. So then the question is, how do we as activists, how do we as proponents of civil liberties, of social justice, and respecting women, how do we reach out and get a hold of the people in society who desperately need to hear us say, it's not okay the way you treat people? This is one of the, I think, questions that we all should be legitimately asking about the role of social media and the spread of social justice. By sharing things on Facebook or on Twitter, of reposting and retweeting and using all the different avenues that we have, and even sort of relying on blogs and sites like BuzzFeed and the popular sort of social medially enhanced websites like that, is that we kind of self-select the audience that we have. Now, I mean, the way to look at this is, imagine if you are friends with somebody on Facebook who's constantly posting about football. Now, if you don't like football, you're probably either going to do maybe one of two things. Either hide the person so that you don't see their posts, or you're just not going to be their friend anymore. You're going to delete them off your account. You know, likewise with Twitter, you're not going to follow somebody who is constantly posting about things you don't care about. That's just ridiculous. So we naturally will self-select the people that we are interested in hearing from. And we naturally self-select the people who are interested in hearing what we have to say. Again, if you're posting about football and somebody posts on one of your feeds and gives you this really long, unpleasant argument about why football is stupid and why you're stupid for believing that football is interesting and blah, 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 you're not going to be friends with this person much longer. These Facebook arguments are going to erupt, and eventually you're just going to be like, you know what, screw this person, delete it. Well, because of this self-selection, though, the downside is that when we post this material, when we get into these long conversations about it, we're engaging with people who more or less share our worldview. And this is something that's been backed up by a lot of science. We tend to make friends with people who are like us. We tend to be friends with people who share our political views, are sort of in our age group, are in our economic class. We don't tend to branch out a whole lot beyond our comfort zone. So again, I think it's fantastic that people are sharing these stories about misogyny and the dangers of sort of this men's rights activism bullcrap. And it's great to see that hashtag Yes All Women is trending and it's being, you know, retweeted and everything like that. But again, it's the focus from on this hashtag and by people around it are people who already agree with it. It's being highlighted by the people who already buy into this view. It's not getting traction with the people who hate it, who don't care about it. It's not getting traction with the people who disagree. And ultimately, if we're going to change society, if we're going to change anyone's mind, we need to start reaching out to people who don't agree with us. And that sounds, I know, because I've been involved in this movement for a long time, that sounds irritating and dumb. And it also sounds like a waste of time, because the people who disagree with us usually are very frustrating to us, and we don't want to reach out to them. So, if we don't want to reach out to them, then we have to think of ways that we can at least present our opinions in ways that don't get blocked by the biases and the blinders that exist out there. That's one of the ongoing questions of the sector. How do we even do that? How do we utilize these tools that are at our fingertips in a way that allows us to express our opinion without getting shut down, or without falling into an echo chamber where everything we say is gleefully agreed with, but so what? It's not like we need to convince our best friends about what we say. They already probably agree with us. So when we go forward with these sorts of ideas, how can we go about making sure that we're phrasing ourselves, our ideologies, our philosophies, our feelings about these matters in a way that is also going to provoke reasonable discussion, that's not going to make someone just shut down and plug their ears, that's going to make someone who's not necessarily in agreement with us sit down and say, I better listen to what these people are saying. That could very well be the challenge, the great challenge of all activism and all social media and all social justice. How do we get people to listen to us when they don't already agree with us? I wish I had the answer to that. Because if I did, well, I would be doing something else right now. I mean, I would probably actually would be still doing the sector. I would just be doing more things in addition to the sector. While we ruminate on these issues, let's take a bit of a musical interlude here on The Sector. This is a song from Paul McCartney's new album, appropriately titled New. This is Queenie Eye.
There were rules you never told me. Never came up with a plan. All the stories that you told me didn't help me understand. But I had to get it worked out. Had nobody who could help. So that in the end it turned out that I had to do it by myself. Life's a game. Racks and riches. Dogs and bitches. Hunt for fame. Difficult to know.
Queenie Eye off of Paul McCartney's new album New. It's interesting, you know, for a guy who was born with more than his fair share of songwriting talent, he really hasn't missed a beat in all these years. Quite impressive. Well, anyway, on last show, I mentioned the donor pyramid. So just what is the donor pyramid and why is it important? Well, the pyramid, and it's more like a triangle, actually, is a way to visualize donations. Even though it's sometimes viewed as a bit archaic by today's standards, the donor pyramid remains a pretty useful way to understand how the process of donations work. So starting with the base of the pyramid, you have the first-time donors, the people who donate in donation boxes or through newsletters or online or really anywhere, actually. But they are a pool of people who might only give once. You know, typically these amounts are fairly low, and they usually come after being asked a few times already. Moving up at the second level, you have annual givers. And these are people who give regularly, maybe on a monthly basis, but more likely it's on a yearly basis. And they support you throughout the year with small gifts here and there, donation boxes, that sort of thing, but as well as giving to your annual campaign, or responding through direct mail, or maybe at a special event, or even with membership programs, and even online giving. This is the level that every fundraiser wants to move you into, the repeat giver. Why? Well, it's actually the person who is most likely to give you something is somebody who has already given to you in the past. And even within this grouping, there is actually a sort of another tier, and that is people who give on monthly installments. These people are the most likely to give to a campaign or a project or really anything. As somebody who's already invested in you enough that they might give you $10 a month, maybe with like a credit card, donation program or something like that. But either way, it's these people who provide the most opportunity for giving to charities. Above annual giving is the category known as major gifts. And as the name suggests, major gifts are the big donations that get hospital wings named after you. Typically, these are from a very small pool of donors who give to capital campaigns, which is just a fancy way of saying a big project that your organization is working on, or they give through endowment gifts, or maybe a very large grant. And the major gifts, they generally come from the annual gifts. So you can see how this whole pyramid thing comes together. Each step leads into the next. Now, if major gifts is only the third level up, what's at the top of the donor pyramid? This is planned giving. And no, plan doesn't mean that you thought ahead and made a donation. Planned giving, also known as legacy giving, is where you leave money to a charity or a foundation in your will. So you might leave 10% of your estate to a charity, or you might give them a house or an office space that you own, property, or it could just be cash as well, given right out of your will. These gifts are usually the largest and the most far-reaching of all donations. The interesting thing about it is that the donor in question doesn't even have to be particularly wealthy, especially if the gift is from an estate. 10% can be a large number depending on how much assets there are and the net worth of the individual. I mean, after all, if you were to total up all the property that you own, all of your goods and your assets and your car and your property and your furniture and everything that you have, and then gave it a value in your estate and then gave 10%, say, to a charity, that's going to add up to quite a lot. It's a very popular way for someone who is really passionate about a charity or a cause, but lacks the funds to make an organizational changing donation. Therefore, making a planned gift can often be a way to, for someone of a medium income, a medium means, to have a really huge impact on the direction of a charity and how it develops. So that, in a nutshell, is the donor pyramid. You have the first-time or one-time givers at the bottom, and they hopefully graduate into the annual givers who give either once a year or maybe a couple times in small amounts throughout the year. Hopefully you can move them into a monthly giving program or a group where they give on a very frequent basis so that when you call them up to donate, they're more than happy to give again. And maybe some of those people who have the means, who have the ability to make a major gift, hopefully that you're able to steward them, that you're able to guide them into a position where they feel comfortable making a large donation to your charity. And then, of course, the final stage, and again, I mean, final is the right word for this, planned giving, when you make a donation in your will. And it's kind of interesting because, I mean, at that point in your life, well, as your life comes to an end, you don't need money anymore. Assuming that you've already taken care of your family, your kids, or your pets in some cases, at that stage, why not spread some wealth around and help make things better? And again, if you think about this as sort of a lifelong journey, you might become a donor to an organization, who knows, in your 20s maybe. You might finally reach the financial point where you're able to give on a monthly basis, perhaps $10 or $20 or $50 a month. You make maybe a large donation in a couple, you know, 10, 20 years maybe. You decide to make a large donation, and a large major gift can be, well, it depends on the organization, I guess. And then, you know, as things wind down and you've been a major supporter for this organization for a long time, you decide to put them in your will. It's something that happens pretty often, and it's really important for sort of the life cycle of a charity. So the donor pyramid, it sounds pretty perfect. It sounds like a really well-ordered, well-thought-out little way to think about donations for a nonprofit, right? Well, not exactly. The donor pyramid has fallen under some criticism, in fact, some pretty serious and well-researched criticism. Essentially, the argument is that the donor pyramid is a very archaic way of looking at donations and nonprofits and how the donor relationship with a nonprofit is changing. And why is it changing? Well, a lot of it has to do with the internet, online giving, social media, and the explosion of exposure to new nonprofits and new charities that are springing up. There's way more causes out there, and there's not enough people. This is sort of the weakness of the donor pyramid, is that we assume that everybody is going to give in a certain way, that you're going to kind of graduate as a donor, that your donations are going to accelerate, grow, level up, as it were, and that everyone is going to have the same process. The problem is that we're not retaining people in the nonprofit sector the same way we were in the past. And this is partly because of, well, there's other interests out there. There's other factors that make us donate now, whether it's financial reasons, whether we're looking for a tax receipt, whether we are supporting four or five different charities, or whether our giving feelings have changed. These things happen. So this sort of one-size-fits-all approach is not necessarily going to work in today's changing environment. The other major problem is that if you're not a traditional on-the-grid person who's going to get the occasional phone call to donate to such and such cause, you may never be brought into the system. So what many are arguing for is a new way of looking at the donor process, one that understands that there needs to be there needs to be no fixed entry point. You can't have a system that is only going to attract people through direct mail or phone calls or even just events, because that's going to leave out a huge group of people who, you know, they don't go to events, maybe they don't have an address that's easily mailed to, And you know what? Most people don't have landlines anymore. So phoning is not going to work on these people. This is where sort of the online component has come into the forefront. I mean, in some cases, it is replacing that entry point, but in other ways, it's simply not sufficient for the donor pyramid or for a system like it. You need to have a more flexible, you need to have a more open-ended way of getting into the system and moving through it. There are a number of other concerns with the donor pyramid that I think trouble a lot of people in today's fundraising environment. One of those concerns is that the donor pyramid seems to imply that the more money you give, the more important you are. And thus, the more resources get put on you to keep you happy, to keep you informed, and to steward you and to guide you in your, you know, career as a giver. But this, of course, is perhaps the wrong approach. In theory, there's only a handful of people out there who can make those huge donations that, you know, change the way your organization works. But there's an awful lot of people out there who can give you at levels that, you know, are good, maybe $100, $200, $500. They occupy that zone of, I'm obviously a serious donor because I've given you, you know, a couple, maybe $1,000 in the course of 5 years. But I'm not a major gift donor. I'm not somebody who's going to change the world. But I can afford to give you maybe $500 a year. These sort of middle range donors are often what I consider a silent majority. They're one of the most important groups of people who help provide the backbone, the lifeblood of any organization, but they're also one of the most neglected in terms of stewardship and guidance from the organization. And this is unfortunate because they are very important. And they're one of the easier groups to reach out to because many of these people, all they really need is a thank you. They need a bit of engagement, perhaps a couple conversations from a board member or an invitation for a special event. It's not complicated to reach out to these people because, again, they are giving you money. It may not be major gift money, but it's still impressive amounts of money. And you should be engaging them. You should be touching base with them and figuring out what you can do to maintain that donation. Another criticism of the donor pyramid is from the point of view of it's not supportive of a donor's needs. It's not donor-centric. And what that means is focusing on the donor sometimes means that you're doing what's best for them and not for your organization or you. So what does that mean? How does that play out with the way we look at a nonprofit? Well, a donor has more than one way of impacting your organization. We sometimes forget that. But aside from pulling out their checkbook, a donor can also make a big impact through their influence, their networks, their communication, their endorsements, their volunteering, their expertise. All of these are aspects that are invaluable to the nonprofit, especially one that is trying to grow and expand and increase its influence. So having an approach that treats donors less like an ATM and more like an expert consultant can pay dividends in the long run. Another opportunity for development and change by moving away from the traditional model of the donor pyramid is this idea of reconnecting an organization. In the nonprofit sector, we have this idea of silos. It's an old term, and it basically means that you have the marketing department, the fundraising department, and maybe a few others, and they never ever meet. They are on opposite sides of the river, there is a wall between them, there are guards on the wall, and the guards have dogs, and their tails are snakes. Okay, well that's a bit of an exaggeration, but you get the idea. Silos, it sort of creates these territories within an organization, and no one really knows what the other group does, or rankfully, how to work together and make sure things are working okay. But by having a different approach, by breaking down these silos and moving into a more integrated way of looking at things. So for instance, marketing, whether you consider that things like advertisements or mail or direct mail or outreach, now they have to work with social media. And fundraisers have to work with them because they don't want a message getting out there that's not a part of how they communicate to donors. So everybody has to be interconnected. They have to be aware of what each other is doing so that as a fundraiser, I'm not accidentally screwing over the marketing department if I release new information to a high-profile donor. And if I'm in marketing, I'm not accidentally screwing over the fundraising department by spreading around news that was earmarked for some of our major gift providers. This way, we're working together, we're aware of what's going on, and that's always a good thing. Being aware of what's going on in your organization, I am going to make a point that it's always a good thing. That's the kind of high-profile advice you come to the sector for. It's always good to know what's going on. Well, okay, but this is some of the reasons why the donor pyramid is viewed as archaic and not necessarily the best fit for more organizations. Modernization and how we communicate with donors has changed the landscape, and the donor pyramid might become a relic of the past. Now, all that being said, there is still some worthwhile information to consider about the donor pyramid. Much of what I said about the levels of donation, the monthly giving, the first-time givers who graduate into sort of the annual givers, who hopefully graduate into the monthly givers, who can graduate into the major gifts, that's still pretty true. And with a little bit of modernization, a bit of innovation, that information can be carried over and adapted to fit the changing dynamics of the nonprofit world. And that is our discussion on the donor pyramid for today. Reminder, if you want to learn more about the donor pyramid, visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can download the podcast as well as the show notes for the show and past episodes. Also, why not visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast and follow us on Twitter at sectorpodcast.com. Or you can follow me, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow. Well, we are running out of time for another episode here on The Sector. And once again, we were dark last week, but we are back this week and we'll be back next week for more here on The Sector. So be sure to tune in again Fridays at 8 a.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Let's go on to our big question of the week. For today's episode, the big question is on engagement. And specifically, I want to talk a bit about engaging with somebody who disagrees with you. Now, I mentioned at the start of the show, we were going on about social justice and the sort of echo chamber that exists thanks to social media, thanks to our connected ability to reach out to people, we tend to gravitate towards people who already agree with us. And we tend to push away against people who don't agree with us. We create these bubbles of support around us where we expose ourselves, we bare our hearts, and we talk about the deep beliefs and values that we have, which is great, but they fall upon the ears of people who already share them, for the most part. I mean, not always, but for the most part. So the big question is, when was the last time you engaged with somebody on a important, deeply held, ingrained belief that you have, and this person, here's the kicker, this person didn't agree with you. They didn't share your values. And I'm not talking about like a Facebook argument where you post on your friend's wall and then some person that, you know, knows your friend talks to you and it gets really heated and you're yelling at each other with, you know, explanation points, blah, blah, blah. That's not what I mean. I mean an actual conversation where you sat down with somebody in a respectful way, and someone that you thought of as intelligent and creative and someone that you felt, you know, deserves a good talking to, and someone who's going to respect your opinions. And you debated something that you feel passionate about, that you think is important, that you think matters, but that they didn't agree with you, that, and you had a verbal joust, maybe. So tell us about that. What was it like for you? How did you navigate that situation? Did you argue to your wit's end? Did you reach a conclusion? Was there a consensus in the end? Or did you agree to disagree? Or maybe you avoided it. Maybe when you realized that there was a disagreement, it was kind of this, oh, I don't know about this moment, and you guys kind of backed away. Maybe that happened. So let us know, what was it like for you, and give us some feedback on the experience and maybe some advice you might have going forward. And again, please communicate with us here at The Sector. We want to hear your thoughts about the big question. And once again, you can share those thoughts with us via email. Send us one at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, or you can share your thoughts in Twitter format. I am at Ethan Clow, and you can tweet us at The Sector, at Sector Podcast. And of course, feel free to share your thoughts with us on Facebook or at our blog at sectorwordpress.com. Well, what a great show. I am so happy to be back. I was so busy with work and school and technical problems here on The Sector, which I think will be resolved. But if not, don't worry. I will figure something out. I hope you guys had a nice break as well. The weather has been okay, so maybe you got out and got some sun and hopefully didn't get too sunburned. Well, we have reached the end of another show. My thanks to all you for tuning in here and listening to me on The Sector. Thank you for joining us. This is your host, Ethan Clow, saying see you next week, folks. Say
Bad money makes for bad lovers. Going broke under